Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, May 10th, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a teleforum on President Trump's Religious Liberties Executive Order. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Mr. Gregory Baylor, Senior Counsel and Director of the Center for Religious Schools at the Alliance Defending Freedom, and Professor Carl Esbeck, Professor of Law Emeritus at the University of Missouri School of Law. I will turn it over to Professor Esbeck to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us. The floor is yours.
Well, good afternoon. So President Trump issued his Religious Liberty Executive Order last Thursday. That happened to be the National Day of Prayer, a day of symbolic importance to religious Americans, but probably a day that was unrecognized by a lot of America. It came along with a Rose Garden signing, and the evening before, an elaborate dinner in the Blue Room at the White House. And that was the kind of event where people not only paid attention as to who got invited, but who didn't get invited. In any case, if you listen to the press reports out of the White House, it was a thank you to conservative religious communities for high voter turnout. And if you listen to the critics, it was just a cheap photo op along with a free dinner at taxpayer expense. The executive order itself was fairly lean. One WAG referred to it as an executive suggestion. The content was really just sections 2, 3, and 4. Section 1 was merely hortatory about what a good thing religious liberty is, and the balance of the executive order was typical boilerplate, the sort of things like it doesn't give rise to a private right of action. So let me, before plunging into the executive order itself, give a little bit of background. Soon after the election, there was chatter inside the Beltway and a little bit even outside about the president-elect, shortly after the inauguration, issuing, if not that very day, the very next day, a host of executive orders, one of which would address religious liberty, if not on the first day or two, certainly within the first week of the presidency. That, of course, didn't happen. There was also substantial evidence that the vice president, Vice President Pence, had given a promise that the Russell Amendment, which was part of the National Defense Reauthorization Bill from the prior Congress, and it didn't make it into that bill because it was opposed by the president and Democratic senators, but that there would be a Russell Amendment executive order. So now we get a little deeper into the presidency, where 1st of February there was a leaked executive order, and obviously the executive order was leaked by somebody who didn't want it issued. And it was widely circulated, had quite a long list of about 10, 11, 12 items, all addressed to sort of longstanding religious liberty concerns of conservatives. And so the leaking of the executive order, of course, had the intended result. It was immediately picked up by the popular press and by activist groups on the left, very strongly opposing it. There was the usual videos of talking heads opining that it was unconstitutional and so on. So there was denial in the White House that there was to be an executive order very shortly, and that this was a draft along with many, many other drafts that were circulated. Then another month goes by, and Senator Langford from Oklahoma, Senator Blunt from my own state of Missouri, other senators circulated and issued a letter addressed to the president saying that there's a long due job not yet done yet by the president to get out a religious liberty executive order. It was, again, widely speculated that during the Holy Week of Easter, then there would be an executive order forthcoming. That wouldn't have been very ecumenical. So obviously, for good reasons, they ultimately landed on the National Day of Prayer, which, of course, involves all major religious bodies in the United States. There's one other sort of important background thing, and that is because of the leaked executive order, and even if that hadn't happened, I think this probably would happen, a number of groups, of course, watched what happened to the executive orders concerning immigration. They get issued, and then some West Coast federal district judge issues a nationwide preliminary injunction, which brings everything to a halt. It heightens the politics of an issue, which is already highly sensitive, and it does a lot of damage to one side of the issue because there's sort of an unanswered federal injunction, which comes down very sharply on one side of the issue. So the thought was, you know, if there's to be a religious liberty executive order, we don't want to have a repeat of that. That would simply damage the particular religious liberty issues that were brought up in any executive order. The American Civil Liberties Union, Lambda Legal Defense, both announced that they were awaiting the executive order and would be filing lawsuits by the end of the day. So there was concern that this might simply do more harm than good. And so, you know, we lawyers tend to think of, well, what does the executive order actually do in terms of positive law? What law gets changed? What was not changed? But there's a much bigger issue here that lawyers don't often think of, and that's public perception, public relations, and so on. So I think all of that is kind of swirling. And finally, the White House reveals their executive order or executive suggestion, if you will. So I'm going to talk about very briefly, Section 4 of the executive order. And that addresses the Department of Justice, and it gives the Department of Justice discretion to issue guidance, which, of course, could take the form of regulation or simply policy changes. And the guidance would be administration-wide or executive administration-wide on religious liberty statutes and executive orders. And of course, there's a well-known sort of dozen areas of federal legislation which address religious liberties. For example, you could take up Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 64, which protects to some extent religious practices of employees, but also religious beliefs and practices of religious employers. There is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which, of course, is all about protecting of religion. There's never been a set of regulations promulgated under RFRA. There's the American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978, and that could be expounded upon. And as to executive orders, President Obama issued an executive order concerning federal contractors and the prohibited bases of discrimination in employment by those contractors, and adding the bases of sexual orientation and gender identity. So the Department of Justice is authorized to use its discretion to flesh out what all that federal legislation and executive orders might mean. So all of that is to kick the can down the road a little bit, but that might not be an altogether good thing. It certainly didn't draw litigation because at the end of the day last Thursday, both Lambda Legal and ACLU announced that they wouldn't be filing lawsuits. So with that background, let me turn it over to Greg Baylor.
Well, thank you, Carl, for that excellent overview, and thanks to the Federalist Society for the honor of participating in this teleforum. My primary task is to talk about Sections 2 and 3 of President Trump's executive order. Section 2 is entitled Respecting Religious and Political Speech. Section 3 is entitled Conscience Protections with Respect to the Preventive Care Mandate. So Section 2 is primarily concerned with what most folks call the Johnson Amendment. The Johnson Amendment has that name because it started out as an amendment to a piece of legislation proposed by Lyndon Johnson back in 1954 when he was a senator from Texas. Under the Johnson Amendment, a tax-exempt, tax-deductible organization can jeopardize its 501c3 status by participating or intervening in any political campaign on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate for public office. You could probably tell that I was quoting the language from the statute. The statute explicitly declares that one can be guilty of so-called participation or intervention by publishing or distributing statements. As a consequence of that, many, including my organization, Alliance Defending Freedom, have expressed concerns that the Johnson Amendment has deterred clergy from addressing important public issues from the pulpit because, you know, they're afraid that they would perhaps jeopardize their house of worship's tax-exempt status. They've been, I think, particularly concerned that statements from a religious perspective on, you know, moral and important policy issues might be deemed an implied endorsement of a candidate who happens to agree with their views on that issue. So during the campaign, President Trump called for the repeal of the Johnson Amendment, and after he became president at the National Prayer Breakfast that Carl mentioned that occurred back in February, he kind of famously said he would, quote, totally destroy the Johnson Amendment. So then we come to last week, May 4, and he issues the executive order. And let me read to you what he says in his order about the Johnson Amendment. It basically says the Department of Treasury shall not take any adverse action against any individual, house of worship, or other religious organization on the basis that such individual or organization speaks or has spoken about moral or political issues from a religious perspective where speech of similar character has, consistent with law, not ordinarily been treated as participation or intervention in a political campaign or on behalf of a candidate. So what does all that mean? Well, it certainly does not mean that the Johnson Amendment is a nullity. The president certainly did not promise not to enforce. He did not promise not to enforce it. Let me get that right. And I think it's fair to say that the language essentially imposes a non-discrimination obligation on the Treasury Department. You know, the IRS under this executive order can't treat sort of maybe putative or potential violators of the Johnson Amendment worse because the controversial statements, the potentially problematic statements that they've made are from a religious perspective as opposed to a secular perspective. One of the problems with this is that there really, I don't believe there's any evidence that that's what is happening, that the IRS under any administration has sort of singled out religious bodies who are sort of bumping up against the line of the Johnson Amendment compared to secular entities. I mean, the problem all along that ADF and others have been concerned about is not so much the IRS's enforcement actions, but about the sort of sword of Damocles that hangs over the head of so many who would like to address public policy issues, even campaign issues, from a moral and religious perspective, but are afraid to because of fear of the IRS. Some of the president's statements, quite candidly, I think create a misimpression that the Johnson Amendment is gone and now pastors and others are free to endorse candidates or to do anything that used to be or still is inconsistent with the Johnson Amendment. And that is simply not the case. And I think, you know, pastors should continue to be prudent and consult legal counsel about what they ought to do and not just sort of take a soundbite from the president's speech and count on that as sort of solid legal advice. The last thing I'll say about the Johnson Amendment is this. To the extent you agree that it creates a problem, and I do, it's a statutory problem. It's rooted in a statute. And as a result, the solution is the best solution is a statutory solution. In the last Congress and in the current one, a bill has been introduced. It's called the Free Speech Fairness Act. And it essentially says that we're not going to take away the tax-exempt status of a nonprofit if it makes, based on the content of their statements made in the ordinary course of business and that do not result in more than de minimis additional expenses. This is probably the best way of dealing with the Johnson Amendment. It does not allow tax-exempt, tax-deductible 501c3s to sort of become, you know, filters for money to candidates for political purposes, which is one of the concerns expressed about a wholesale repudiation of the Johnson Amendment. And so we think that strikes the right balance. And if the president would like to make a concrete difference in this area, perhaps he can give some attention to supporting the Free Speech Fairness Act. The other task that I have is to talk about Section 3 of the executive order, which is called Conscience Protections with Respect to Preventive Care Mandate. This obviously concerns the HHS contraceptive mandate, which is well known to all of you. It's rooted in a provision of the Affordable Care Act that requires many employee and student health plans to cover a particular list of preventive services without cost sharing. The statute itself, of course, does not identify contraceptives per se, but it gives discretion to the Department of Health and Human Services to sort of create a list of things that constitute preventive health services, particularly women's preventive health services. HHS, of course, among other things, included in its list all FDA-approved contraceptives. They also crafted a religious exemption that many thought was extraordinarily narrow, was limited to churches, religious orders, integrated auxiliaries, and the like, and left out most religious nonprofits, Christian colleges and daycare centers and social service agencies, K-12 schools, and all the rest. They were on the outside of the scope of that religious exemption. Also on the outside of it were for-profit companies that resulted in litigation both by for-profit companies, Hobby Lobby, and by a host of religious nonprofits. Candidate Trump, of course, was encouraged by many to deal with this. When he became president, and there was hope and expectation that he would promptly address it. The most obvious remedy in the eyes of many is just simply to expand that religious exemption to include a broader class, perhaps all religious nonprofits with an objection, or perhaps all nonprofits with a religious or moral objection, and perhaps even all entities maybe reaching out and including closely held for-profit companies that have a religious or moral objection. So there was hope that he might accomplish that through an executive order, and that's certainly not what Section 3 of last week's executive order says. It only says that the relevant cabinet secretaries shall consider issuing amended regulations designed to sort of deal with the conscience-based objections. And so I'm not sure how much it changes the status quo. There have been negotiations between counsel for the parties challenging the mandate that started in the wake of the Zubik Supreme Court order last year, both with officials with the Obama administration and the Trump administration. It certainly doesn't help, doesn't hurt the cause, rather, when you have an image of the Little Sisters of the Poor on the stage with the president and him making a sidebar remark that, you know, you just won your case. But at the same time, you know, those statements obviously don't have legal effect, and the executive order, Section 3, doesn't sort of dictate any particular resolution, and it essentially orders these secretaries to do something that they're already doing. So with that, I will conclude my prepared remarks, and then I'll turn it to Laura to facilitate a time of questions and answers.
Great. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. And while we're waiting for that first question, Professor Esbeck, is there anything you'd like to respond to?
Well, maybe just a couple of additional things on the Johnson Amendment. You know, it was reported in the press after this executive order was signed, and accurately, that a lot of clergy, at least white clergy, don't want the ability to endorse candidates as a cleric or pastor or priest. And that's true, and some of them said they sort of enjoyed the ability of turning down a powerful layperson in their church by turning down a request to endorse a candidate by simply saying, well, I can't do that because that's unlawful. And if the Johnson Amendment goes, well, of course, they'll no longer have that ability to fall back on what's prohibited by the IRS. But, of course, whether they endorse candidates from the pulpit or not is entirely their prerogative. And in many cases, it would be divisive within their congregation. And but there are a number of clergy who do want to do that, and it's widely done in African American churches. So, you know, there's a little bit of concern there of churches being treated differently based on race. And then there's a somewhat different concern. While there's not a lot of religious liberty concern about the Johnson Amendment, the worry was that that our president would take care of that issue and then sort of say, okay, I've taken care of you religious liberty people, and not deal with this long list of other standing concerns where religious liberty runs up against other interests.
Again, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, May 11th. That call will feature author Professor Thomas W. Hazlett, who will join us to discuss his latest book, The Political Spectrum, The Tumultuous Liberation of Wireless Technology from Herbert Hoover to the Smartphone. Let's go to our first question.
Hi, Professor Carl and Greg. This is Paul Broderson with Samaritan Ministries International. I'm just curious, you'd mentioned the potential policy and also regulations that may stem from this. I'm just wondering if you've seen anything or heard of anything coming down with regard to that.
Well, I think you're referring to Section 4, which authorizes Department of Justice to issue guidance, and the guidance could be the form of promulgated regulations, or it could simply be policy statements. There's been nothing out of Department of Justice. We've seen that they're otherwise engaged just right now. So that's understandable. And after all, this executive order is has just been out there for 6 days. But we did see, concerning the contraception mandate, and Greg, you might want to say a little bit more about this, but I think it was later that afternoon, the afternoon of May 4th, that the secretary over at HHS issued a press release referring to his new authority under the executive order, or new impetus to pay attention to this contraceptive mandate litigation and get it resolved. And I don't have that press release right in front of me, but it was very upbeat in the sense that, yes, we're looking at that and we're certainly conscious of our religious liberty obligations, and so we're gonna be dealing with that. Greg, do you want to say any more about that?
Yeah, you know, Carl's exactly right. On the same day, Secretary Price of HHS did release a statement, and he said that he sort of welcomed the executive order directing his agency to reexamine the previous administration's interpretation. And he went farther and said that they will be taking action in short order to safeguard deeply held religious beliefs. One other comment that's worth making about this is most of the courts of appeals in these pending cases, you might recall that when the Supreme Court did what it did in the Zubik case, they sent things essentially back down to the courts of appeals for discussion, conversation, negotiation between the parties, because the court had discerned in oral argument and in supplemental briefing some potential common ground that the parties ought to explore before essentially requiring the court to resolve some of these issues. And as I mentioned before, there have been some conversations. They haven't yet yielded a resolution. But one of the interesting things is the courts of appeals have been unsurprisingly, you know, happy to allow the parties to deal with this, to, you know, so that they don't have to deal with it. But there was one exception to this. The Seventh Circuit, in the case that was filed by Notre Dame against the administration, they issued an order in March, essentially trying to, you know, let's get this going, let's bring this to a conclusion. And that court issued an order requiring the parties in that case, which of course included Notre Dame and the government, to either report an agreement or to submit detailed position statements. And the court indicated in its order that that would soon be followed by oral argument. The deadline for that was May 1st, and when May 1st rolled around, the status report did not report a resolution. It did report that the parties have been working and having productive discussions, that they met on April 25th, and that the agencies were considering further administrative action to see what might be appropriate. And they asked the court to give them essentially more time to refrain from scheduling oral argument and offering to file status reports on June 1st. To my knowledge, the Seventh Circuit has not yet reacted to that filing, but I think it is noteworthy that at least one court is wanting to move these things along while the others are happy to sort of be in a wait-and-see mode.
Just sort of a little bit of additional background to that. At the Rose Garden signing was Little Sisters of the Poor. They're one of the many litigants who brought lawsuits, the contraception mandate lawsuits, against the Obama administration. And the president turned to them and said, oh, your problem's going to be taken care of. This isn't going to happen to you anymore. But, of course, that was just off-the-cuff talk by the president. And we've, you know, yet to see concrete action. Is the Department of Justice, representing the United States in the litigation, going to offer a settlement that that the plaintiffs, including the Little Sisters of the Poor, can take?
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Jameson Taylor with the Mississippi Center for Public Policy. I wanted to, Professor Espack kind of touched on this, but as I looked at the executive order and also see proponents of religious liberty hoping for another executive order, saying this is just the first step, but we're going to get more. What I wonder is maybe we don't want any more executive orders because they're going to be interpreted more as a floor. Rather than a floor, they're going to be interpreted as a ceiling. And Professor Espack, you kind of touched on that, but I want to hear a little bit more conversation about that.
Well, I did see a couple of press reports that used the phrase, well, this is just the first step. I didn't see any that went on to say, and the next step or the next step will be more executive orders. This is speaking for myself. I think you've seen the only executive order that there's going to be on religious liberty from this president in this 4 years. But I think when I say kick the can down the road, and I don't mean to demean what's happening here, I think it's going to move down to the departmental level and even below that, either on a case-by-case basis or on an issue basis, to, in fact, change some policies or promulgate some regulations, which will deal in very specific ways with particular issues.
Yeah, the only thing that I would add, and I discerned in your question a concern about sort of the permanence of executive orders, and you know, obviously just about anything can be overturned in this country, but you know, obviously a congressional response to some of these problems may be among the better solutions. I mentioned before the Free Speech Fairness Act, which many believe would be a better response to the perceived concerns about the Johnson Amendment. There's also the First Amendment Defense Act, which would essentially prohibit the federal government from denying benefits to individuals and organizations because of their views on marriage and perhaps even on gender as well. Those kinds of, and also, you know, one of the conflicts in the religious liberty arena has been created by administrative reinterpretation of the word sex in various non-discrimination statutes to reach sexual orientation and or gender identity. There's a question about the validity of that. There's the question about whether existing religious exemptions protect religious organizations from claims brought under that enhanced or expanded interpretation of the statute. There was a bill in the last Congress called the Civil Rights Uniformity Act, which would have clarified what the word sex means across the federal code and the Code of Federal Regulations to essentially eliminate some of those religious liberty problems. So in addition to the possibility of further executive orders, and I share Professor Espack's skepticism about that, and executive branch action like regulations, policy statements, maybe Office of Legal Counsel opinions, perhaps the best way to protect religious liberty would be for Congress to take action and the president to sign it.
Yeah, I agree with Greg Baylor that the right way to handle this is for Congress to pass legislation. And that legislation would naturally reflect each side getting some of what they want and not getting everything that they wanted. But our pattern is that Congress can't pass this legislation. They're gridlocked. And so then the next step is we look to the third branch, which isn't gridlocked, and ultimately things get resolved in the federal courts. And now with a ninth justice on the Supreme Court, we're no longer split 4-4 there on some of these issues. So, you know, we'll get a resolution. And some of those justices, their thoughts on these issues are fairly well defined, but some of them are swing justices still. And so litigating, which is an all-or-nothing proposition, litigating is going to leave one side really happy and the other side very sad.
Let's go to the next question.
This is Stephen Casey from Austin, Texas. My question is this. You know, executive orders and the little amount of weight that they hold. And throughout the campaign and throughout what I've observed of President Trump, he doesn't seem to have a unequivocal set of principle, religious principles that he abides by. You mentioned with your comment, you know, to the Little Sisters of the Poor, oh, your case has been solved. What person from who I would suggest probably listening to this call or, you know, is in there that has his ear that is going to be the principled religious philosopher, legal philosopher, to whom he's listening and from whom he's drawing his conclusions and principles? Because right now he's all over the place. And I don't really think he has a set of critical theological / legal thinking skills of his own. So who is he relying on, and what does that maybe foretell about how this is going to pan out?
Oh boy. Who is he relying on? Of course, there's a lot of people in America who don't have a thoroughgoing, thought out position on religious liberty simply because they don't think about these things, and they're experts in other areas that are of more pertinence to them. I say nothing new than the press reports that he looks to his vice president, who's known to be an individual who has thought through and has a definite position on religious liberty. He also looks to his daughter, Ivanka, and her husband on these issues. And the president himself has said several times, first on the campaign trail, but then now as president, that he is not anti-gay. And, you know, he's been fairly consistent in that regard. Nothing he's done has decided for religious liberty over gay rights. Other than that, Greg, do you have some thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any sort of a fly-on-the-wall perspective about who's speaking into the president's ear. And I can only sort of mimic what we've heard in the press accounts, which Carl recounted. The evidence of, you know, about his views on gay rights and the relative priority with religious liberty certainly were revealed to some extent when President Trump declined to modify or partially rescind Executive Order 13672, which was President Obama's addition of sexual orientation and gender identity to the list of protected characteristics in the executive order that bans employment discrimination by federal contractors. At the same time, the competing evidence is what he did with respect to Title IX. You may recall that both the Department of Justice and the Department of Education Office for Civil Rights had started interpreting Title IX to prohibit discrimination not just on the basis of sex traditionally understood, but also on the basis of gender identity. They also had a very expansive understanding of what sort of counts as gender identity discrimination. Their view was that kind of accommodations of persons suffering with what used to be called gender identity disorder were not sufficient, that it was necessary for covered entities to essentially treat these individuals consistent with their subjective self-perception gender identity rather than their biological sex. And he did rescind the Dear Colleague letter, the guidance that those agencies had sent out. It was not a sort of ringing repudiation. It was more, we're going to pull this back and maybe think about it some more. It was kind of reading between the lines. But so I think, you know, I do think he understands that there is a tension between these two objectives, and I think the jury's still somewhat out on how he's going to end up resolving some of these conflicts, if at all.
Of course, Greg is referring there to the Gloucester case, such that shortly before the oral argument in the Supreme Court in the Virginia Gloucester case, that caused the Supreme Court to vacate their grant of certiorari and remand it back to the Fourth Circuit.
I mean, so it would seem though that either Vice President Pence, because you know obviously he was very strong supportive of a RFRA, right? So he's at least got some conceptual idea about that. Is either unable to sway the president, or if you compare those two instances of the gender bathroom issue versus the gay rights altogether, that he seems to come out on the part of the innocent person, because the way that the bathroom ordinances were cast was more of a protect the children. It seems like those things sway him. He's really wants to be seen as the hero and protector, but unless you know someone's in there saying, "Hey, I've got the ear," which obviously, with this thing being as toothless as it was, the vice president didn't have his ear, or maybe had his ear, but he just didn't want to listen to him. That we really have no knowledge of anywhere anything's going.
Well, I don't have it.
Go ahead, Carl.
I don't have anything to add except, you know, the things that are implied by your question, and I'm sure you'd say you're speculating, and so we're all speculating concerning the vice president's persuasive power. It should be said during this call that a concrete thing that the president has done is nominate individuals for federal judicial appointments that are just all around strong people, including on the issue of religious liberty. So that's a positive. And I want to say again, maybe more forthrightly, concerning the executive order. The executive order did no harm. Now, that might sound like a really low standard, but we've seen executive orders that ended up actually harming one side of the issue because some federal district court in some deep blue state issues a nationwide preliminary injunction. So it leaves an impression with the public that the president's position is wrong and others are right. At least this executive order drew no serious lawsuits resulting in a preliminary injunction. Now, it did, just as a footnote for thoroughness here, it did draw one lawsuit out in Madison, Wisconsin, but I really don't think that lawsuit's going to go anywhere, and it was simply directed at the Johnson Amendment section in the executive order.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Ken Masugi, and I had a question that's more about the politics of the order, and I think the last comments segue into this. When I hear about politics from the pulpit, I think more in terms of African American ministers who are predominantly Democrats. And I'm wondering to what extent this order might affect some of the politics that they've been accused of, that is African-American ministers, and whether they were part of the, whether they formed any considerable part of the audience at this White House dinner, or whether any of them had any reaction to it.
Well, this is Greg. I'm not sure of the full attendance lists for the dinner beforehand and for the Rose Garden event. To my knowledge, I know that ADF's Pulpit Freedom Initiative, which was encouraging pastors to essentially test the IRS, did have a significant number of African American pastors participating in it. Our view has always been it's not the particular religious perspective from which you come or which party you appear to be aligned with. It's really the principle about pastors being able to comment on hot current day issues without facing fear. Carl, do you have anything to add?
No.
All right, let's go to our next question.
Hello. I appreciate the federalism concerns that are implicated in my question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Where the rubber really seems to hit the road on a lot of religious liberty issues is at the state level, right? I mean, the contraceptive mandate notwithstanding, because that got a lot of attention, a lot of the nitty-gritty of having one's businesses right, one's rights as a business owner or what have you infringed upon with regard to religion is at the state level. Is there any scuttlebutt appetite whatsoever that you've picked up on with the Trump administration where they might attempt to provide some relief to religious Americans from state regulation that infringes upon the free exercise of their religion?
Well, I haven't really heard too much along those lines. I mean, you know, one of the problems for religious exercise when it's being infringed upon by state and local governments is that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act cannot be invoked against those state and local governments. In its original version, it was intended to do that. It did do that. And then in the City of Bernie versus Flores case, the Supreme Court said that Congress had exceeded its authority and could not impose those sorts of obligations on and duties upon state and local governments. In an ideal world, those of us who support a robust understanding of religious freedom would like to see another effort at restoring the original breadth of RFRA, but that's been a political impossibility since within a few years of RFRA itself. So unsurprisingly, I haven't heard any chatter about, well, let's try to fix some of these state and local problems by enacting a RFRA. The only other thing I would say, and then I'll let Carl chime in, is, you know, the executive order does refer to federal protection of religious liberty, and federal protection of religious liberty is not limited to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and it's not limited to statutes and regulations that restrain the federal government itself. It also includes the Constitution, which, of course, does restrain all levels of government, and it remains to be seen whether in his guidance, the Attorney General will address not only sort of more predictable statutory and regulatory things, but also perhaps provide guidance on constitutional issues, which, you know, would be directed at federal agencies, but would have some persuasive authority about sort of how the Constitution applies in conflicts between religious claimants and state and local government.
Could I be indulged with a related follow-up?
Sure, go ahead.
Do you think there's any appetite on the current Supreme Court to revisit Employment Division versus Smith?
I would say no, because most of what reversing Smith would do is already done by the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Now, I'm aware that RFRA only applies to federal action, not state or local governmental action. And reversing Smith, of course, would go right down to local governments as well as clear up to the federal government. But I see the Supreme Court mostly focused on federal law, federal action, which comes back to your first question. I agree with Greg Baylor that I have not seen, like he said, that any appetite at the federal level to use its spending power or interstate commerce power to shape what state and local governments are doing concerning religious liberty. I also agree with your question that you said most of the religious liberty issues are at the state or local level. I would say a majority
other religious liberty issues are at the state or local level. But we shouldn't discount that increasingly they're at the federal level. For example, Greg mentioned in passing, and I want to emphasize, during the Obama administration, the EEOC and other agencies followed suit, Department of Labor, HHS, Department of Education, Department of Justice. They took this statutory interpretation that sex discrimination also includes discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. And that creates problems with as Title VII and Title IX, as Greg mentioned, but also with Title VIII, the Fair Housing Act, with the federal contracting executive order and the employment practices of federal contractors. So this is a major issue, and it's a federal issue, and personally I think, well, there are bills in front of Congress to solve it, and that is the right place to solve it. I don't think they're going to be able to do it, and the Supreme Court will have to resolve that issue.
All right, looks like we have gone through our first queue of questions. A reminder to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions. Would you both like to make some closing remarks?
Greg, would you like to go first?
Yeah.
I went first earlier.
Yeah. Well, the tone of a lot of what I've said today has been of modest disappointment. And I think that if you perceived that tone, you perceived correctly. But at the same time, I do think it's worth saying that there are some positives that come out of the executive order and the speech that President Trump gave in connection with it. In his speech, he said that Americans shouldn't be forced to choose between the tenets of their faith and the dictates of the government. That's a wonderful principle that we applaud and hope that will find its way into more concrete manifestations and applications of law. The executive order itself, just the fact of it, it demonstrates that the administration has a commitment to religious freedom and is prepared to enforce the laws. A cynic might say that this is just political posturing and positioning, but I would say this, it's better that, from my perspective, as someone who's an advocate for a robust understanding of religious liberty, it's better that he has said it than that he hasn't said it. So I do have some sympathy for those who say that this is just the first step. I hope that that's right and that we'll see more concrete protections of religious liberty coming soon.
I would just add to that, very briefly, that this presidency, we lawyers, I assume most of us are on this call are lawyers, we think in terms of positive law, and we think executive orders are about positive law. I don't think this administration thinks that way. They think in terms of messaging. They think in terms of the kind of public impression that's left. I really don't think they wanted to issue any executive order, but I think their hand was such that they had to do something. And so their idea was to get through this executive order matter and sort of get this monkey off their back and get through the day looking like winners and not losers. And to that extent, they succeeded. There's no serious litigation. There's no consequential nationwide injunctions. And the thing that we don't know and that we simply have to keep an eye out on is things now have moved down to the departmental level and lower levels, and what sort of guidance and policies are going to change consistent with their hortatory language in favor of religious liberty, or is simply nothing going to get done? That's where we have to keep our eyes.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.